to today's reading of Sports Today, a one-hour reading of sports news from 7 to 8 p.m. every Tuesday and Thursday. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Some Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin with a reading from USA Today Sports Weekly that reads, Can Bill Belichick turn North Carolina into a winner? And this feature is written by Dan Wolken, columnist for USA Today. North Carolina has forever been college football's biggest mystery. It's the flagship university in a big state that produces a good amount of talent. It's one of the most prominent brands in all of sports, thanks to an alumnus named Michael Jeffrey Jordan, who almost single-handedly changed how athletes were marketed around the world. And most of all, North Carolina wins in pretty much everything, with national championships in men's basketball, field hockey, men's lacrosse, and women's lacrosse, women's soccer, and men's and women's tennis just in the last 10 years alone. But North Carolina football is the sleeping giant that decade after decade, coach after coach, never wakes up. Now comes Bill Belichick, arguably the best NFL coach of all time, 72 years old and desperate for a last shot that no professional franchise seems to want to give him. In his possession is a manifesto on how to win in modern college football, a staff of familiar names from his New England Patriots days, and an aura that even Nick Saban couldn't live up to. It is wild to say it, but it's true. Belichick is next up to try his hand at turning this perpetually tantalizing job into a winner. He's going to be the Tar Heels football coach. After 467 regular season games coached in the NFL, 44 more in the playoffs, and 6 Super Bowl titles, Belichick and North Carolina are about to consummate perhaps the most unlikely marriage in the history of college football. Do either one of them know what they're getting into? For a lot of people who have long observed or coached in college football, the immediate reaction to Belichick's arrival will be skeptical or even dismissive. In a coaching career that stretches back to 1975, he's never worked a day on a college campus. His last couple of years in New England, after the dynasty he created with Tom Brady crumbled, were not a masterpiece of coaching or roster building. When you read accounts of how he ruled Foxborough with unrelenting, cold-blooded intimidation and fear, the notion of him connecting with undeveloped 18-year-olds and their impatient parents seems impossible. For goodness sakes, North Carolina just fired 73-year-old Mack Brown because the game had passed him by. And the rest of Brown's contemporaries have either retired or fled to the NFL, where they don't have to deal with the headaches of 365 days per year recruiting in the era of revenue sharing and name, image, and likeness. It is fair to wonder how this can possibly work. On the other hand, what do the Tar Heels really have to lose? Just look at their coaching history in the 21st century. John Bunting, a beloved alumnus with NFL coordinator bona fides, was a disaster. They hired a proven college winner in Butch Davis, who not only failed to push the program past mediocrity, he was fired after a raft of NCAA violations. They tried the up-and-comer with Larry Fedora, who had one pretty good year and then burned out completely. And after that, they brought Brown back for a second stint at the school that never yielded a season better than 9 wins, 5 losses. North Carolina has tried pretty much everything. Since 1997, they have finished in the top 25 twice. It's no surprise the moment that Belichick started lobbying for the job that school officials and boosters began to talk themselves into it. If nothing else, merely hiring Belichick and agreeing to his demands on resources, staffing, and player compensation will inspire a level of seriousness and commitment that North Carolina has never put into its football program. So why not? The better question here is, why does Belichick want anything to do with this? After decades of scouting college players for the NFL draft and building relationships with coaches, maybe Belichick thinks that he can X and O circles around these guys. Perhaps that's true. But as any college coach will tell you, even at a time when the top college programs structurally resemble NFL franchises more than ever, their on-field responsibilities are only a fraction of what goes into winning. Belichick may feel familiarity working in an environment where he has to decide how to allocate money on player acquisition and retention, but connecting with and teaching and motivating college players is a far more volatile and difficult job than the fully developed adult professionals that you draft into NFL locker rooms. Belichick may be just so good that he can make it work, but there are 100 ways that it can go wrong, and there's at least some risk to his legacy if it does. Keep in mind, 7 NFL franchises could have hired Belichick last year and did not, including the Atlanta Falcons, who got fairly far down the road with him during the interview process. There are going to be at least that many jobs open this year, and it's hard to believe that Belichick would take North Carolina if he thought he had a good chance at any of them. That isn't just a reflection of his age, but the fact that the NFL collectively determined that he had lost his touch both on the coaching and player evaluation side after the breakup with Brady. And perhaps because teams were skeptical that Belichick just wanted to coach football and not have control of the entire organization the way he did in New England. The fact that Belichick entertained college jobs supports that theory. At North Carolina, he will be the most powerful person on campus. He will rarely be told no. Of all the schools willing to make that deal, it's surprising that North Carolina, a famously staid athletic department that treasures its reputation for coloring inside the lines, is willing to turn the whole place over to a guy who has never spent even a minute coaching in college. Nobody can ever take Belichick's accomplishments away from him. 6 Super Bowls is 6 Super Bowls. But if he flames out at North Carolina, it will be an unceremonious and uncomfortable end to a career that has had many opportunities to finish on a graceful, winning note. But even as an old man whose best coaching years are almost certainly behind him, Belichick is chasing one last high in Chapel Hill. If he can wake North Carolina from its decades-long slumber, it may solidify his reputation as the sport's greatest ever football coach, regardless of level, even without the NFL all-time wins record that he once hoped would be his. Nobody could have seen this coming even a few weeks ago, but now it is real. It may work, or it may blow up spectacularly. But it's going to be fascinating for however long it lasts. And again, that feature is entitled, Can Belichick Turn the University of North Carolina into a Winner? Written by Dan Wolken, columnist for USA Today. And in other college football news, this next feature is about a game that's taking place tomorrow evening, Notre Dame versus Indiana. And the headline reads, Rivalry That Wasn't Takes Center Stage in College Football Playoff. And this feature is written by Michael Nieziolek of the Herald-Times, Stateline, Bloomington, Indiana. Notre Dame has mostly rebuffed Indiana football's efforts to bring the teams together, despite the schools being separated by less than 200 miles. Was it intentional? That's up for debate. Notre Dame had other priorities as it looked to build nationally focused schedules in support of its iconic brand while juggling a series of traditional rivalries. The Hoosiers never fit into those plans outside of a one-off game back in 1991. The schools have a future home-and-home series on the books that is anything but certain given the changing landscape of college football. But that's not a concern this week after the college football playoff put the programs on a collision course. The number 10 seeded Hoosiers, who are currently 11 wins, 1 loss, and 8 wins, 1 loss in the Big Ten, and they will visit South Bend to play number 7 Notre Dame for a first-round college football playoff matchup on December the 20th. That's this Friday at 6 p.m. Arizona time, in a game that could define the future of football in the Hoosier State. While Indiana has not reached anywhere near the same heights of Notre Dame on the gridiron, the Irish have more national titles, 11, than Indiana has bowl wins, 3. Coach Kurt Cignetti labeled the program a, quote, emerging superpower, unquote, after guiding the Hoosiers to an historic 8-win turnaround. Quote, I think all the pressure to win the game is on Notre Dame, Indiana's former athletic director Fred Glass said. Quote, a lot of people nationally don't even think Indiana University belongs in the college football playoff. Under all those circumstances, if Indiana beats Notre Dame at Notre Dame and knocks them out of the national championship playoff, I think that would be an historic humiliation of epic proportion for Notre Dame. I think the pressure is completely on them, unquote. It might be enough to even kick off a true rivalry between the two schools. Indiana Athletic Director Scott Dolson has a unique perspective on the Indiana University-Notre Dame series as a Michigan City native who regularly attended football games in South Bend during his childhood. Dolson went on to become a fixture in Indiana University's athletic department after graduating from the school. He famously spent time as a student manager for Bob Knight and worked his way up from various fundraising roles. When I came down to Bloomington, Notre Dame felt like it was in another part of the United States in some ways, Dolson said. There was so much focus on Indiana and Purdue, and we didn't have a series. It just didn't feel like they were in the same state. Obviously, they aren't in a conference. I think that makes it different as well. It just was always different, unquote. Many football alums feel the same. Indiana Assistant Athletic Director for Alumni Relations, Mark Deal, who was a member of Indiana's famed 1979 team that won the Holiday Bowl, grew up steeped in Hoosiers lore. His father, Mutt, was a captain for the 1945 team that won the Big Ten and regaled him with stories of his decorated career. The team's trip back to South Bend in 1941, when Mutt was then a sophomore, did not conjure the same enmity as battles against Purdue or Michigan State. He never talked about it. Hell, I grew up 50 minutes from Notre Dame, Deal said. I went to Notre Dame games as a kid. It's just not a bitter rivalry. You didn't hate Notre Dame, you admired them. They were just another team you kind of watched from afar, unquote. There was talk through the years about scheduling a series, but it wasn't until Dolson initiated talks back in 2021 that they locked down dates. The schools agreed to play a game in 2030 in South Bend, and I have a 2031 game in Bloomington. Those conversations came as the Big Ten was requiring teams to schedule at least one non-conference Power 5 opponent annually, a requirement that the league has since dropped. Indiana rolled out a series of scheduling announcements that year, including a home-and-home series against the University of Virginia coming in 2027 and 2028. Future games at Memorial Stadium against Old Dominion in 2025 and Colorado State in 2026, and a 2026 game against UConn. There were a lot of moving parts on our schedule. It was like a bunch of moves on a chessboard, Dolson said. That was interesting how it all fell into place, but we just thought that it would be a great thing to add that kind of marquee game, unquote. It was the first discussion between the schools since Glass, Dolson's predecessor, made similar overtures to Notre Dame when he took over back in 2009. He took the job the same year that his friend and former law partner Jack Swarbrick was named Notre Dame's athletic director. The Indiana University job came out of nowhere for me, and I called him to ask, "Is this a good gig? Is this something that I want to do?" Glass said. He strongly encouraged me to take the job. We had worked together with each other for 15 years prior to that on a variety of initiatives for the city of Indianapolis. When I was pursuing the Super Bowl, I pulled in Jack to help me with it, unquote. That rapport did not prompt any change in Notre Dame's ambivalence about scheduling the Hoosiers. Jack is a Bloomington boy, so he is generally sympathetic to Indiana University. But it became clear pretty quickly that it wasn't going to work out, Glass said. Dolson said he always felt Notre Dame simply didn't have room for Indiana, given its list of rivalry games that include Navy, whom they've played 97 times, and Southern California, who have played the Fighting Irish 95 times, and a handful of other Big Ten teams. Notre Dame plays trophy games against Purdue and Michigan State. Its rivalry with Michigan predated all of them. The first matchup between the schools was in 1887. After a lengthy hiatus, Notre Dame and Michigan became must-see television, starting with the reunion game back in 1978. They played almost annually after that through the year 2014. Some of those rivalries were upended when Notre Dame agreed to play 60 games against ACC teams from 2014 to 2025. That left even less room for a potential game against Indiana. "I didn't consider it dismissive," Glass said with a pause. "It just wasn't going to happen given the schedule that Notre Dame needed to pursue. But I'm a little skeptical of whether they would have scheduled it, because it feels like there would be a lot of downside and not a ton of upside," unquote. As Indiana's football coach, Lee Corso brought a surprise guest to practice before the 1979 team's opener. "We were doing two-a-days, and out comes Digger Phelps," Deal said. The then Notre Dame basketball coach was friends with Corso and stopped practice to give the team a pep talk. His message was simple. There was nothing stopping the Hoosiers from reaching a bowl game for the first time in more than a decade. In the years that followed, Phelps joked with Corso that he should have received a bowl ring for Indiana's 38-37 win over BYU in the Holiday Bowl. Phelps was also friends with former Indiana Hoosiers basketball coach Bob Knight, and their friendship ensured the programs were a fixture on each other's schedule. "They always looked forward to playing each other," former Indiana Sports Information Director Kit Klingenhofer said. Their first matchup came after the dedication ceremony at a newly built assembly hall in 1971. Knight and Phelps' first seasons at their respective schools. The Hoosiers won 94-29. The series produced some other memorable moments. During Indiana's undefeated 1975-76 season, the Hoosiers escaped with a 63-60 win in a thriller. The Irish returned to Assembly Hall 2 years later as the undefeated number two team in the country. Indiana guard Wayne Radford's free throws with 4 seconds to go gave the Hoosiers a 67-66 win. "That was a hell of a game," Notre Dame's Adrian Dantley versus Indiana's Scott May, Deal said. "Those games were always in December before Christmas and always had a packed house," unquote. The schools remained frequent sparring partners after the coaches left. Knight ended up with a 14-win, 5-loss record against Phelps, and they would later take part in the Crossroads Classic, an annual tournament at Gainbridge Fieldhouse alongside Purdue and Butler. It highlighted the positive relationships between the athletic departments, but it never opened the door to bringing the football teams together on a more frequent basis. There's an inverse relationship between Indiana football and basketball and Notre Dame football and basketball, Glass said. Notre Dame has a national following, crazy fan base with a lot of success in football, but in basketball, not so much. Indiana has traditionally been a blue blood powerhouse in basketball, but not so much in football, unquote. Leading up to Selection Sunday, Indiana's legendary play-by-play voice, Don Fisher, had a lot of fans asking him who he hoped that Indiana would draw. Quote, I want to play Notre Dame. Are you kidding me? Fisher would ask. I was excited about that possibility, unquote. Fisher has called more than 2,000 Indiana football and basketball games. He has called 4 NCAA men's basketball title games and all but one of Indiana University's 13 bowl appearances. The 1968 Rose Bowl predated his tenure, but he's only called one Indiana University against Notre Dame football game. The prospect of a return to South Bend was thrilling. It's Notre Dame, Fisher said. They are a national program, and they've been a national program as long as I've been alive, unquote. Fisher was on the call when Indiana opened the 1991 season against Notre Dame in their first meeting in 33 years. The game pitted Indiana coach Bill Mallory against fellow Woody Hayes' disciple Lou Holtz. They spent the 1968 season together on Ohio State's staff. It was the first Irish game that aired on NBC as part of the school's groundbreaking television contract with the network. There was a tremendous amount of excitement, Fisher said. It was huge. It was the opening game of the season on top of that, so everybody was all jacked up, unquote. Glass was working in the governor's office at the time as the chief of staff for Evan Bayh. It was such a big game in the state that it helped grease the wheels for a long-requested construction project from fans who regularly made the trek up to South Bend to fix what he described as a quote-unquote notorious pinch point on a railroad track north of Kokomo. The Hoosiers had a talented team with Trent Green at quarterback and Vaughn Dunbar in the backfield. Dunbar, who set a single-season school rushing record that year with over 1,800 yards, had 33 carries for 161 yards in the game. The Irish won 49-27, but the game was more competitive than the final score indicates. There were 5 lead changes in the first half, and the Irish didn't pull away until scoring back-to-back touchdowns at the end of the second quarter that were separated by a surprise onside kick. There's been a lot of years where Indiana wasn't competitive, but they would have had a chance to beat Notre Dame if they played more regularly in those Bill Mallory years, Fisher said. Mallory's teams were really physical, tough teams, unquote. Klingenhofer, who retired in the year 2012 after spending 4 decades in Indiana's athletic department, agrees. He wondered what the result would have been had it taken place towards the end of the 1991 season. We installed a new 4-3 defense, but we got better as the year went on, Klingenhofer said. As exciting as it was for fans, that game didn't lead to further discussions about extending the series, Klingenhofer said. The one-off Indiana-Notre Dame game was agreed to in 1983, with the agreement predating both Mallory's and Holtz's tenure at the schools. It's why you won't hear Klingenhofer use the word rival when talking about the college football playoff matchup. The facts are the facts, Klingenhofer said. You gotta play a team over and over again, just like for us with Purdue and Michigan State. It was more of a rivalry game for us against Kentucky, unquote. As for why the teams remained on their respective sides of the state, Fisher prefers to believe the theory that he most often hears from Hoosiers fans. The joke has always been that they are just too scared, Fisher said with a laugh. That's really why they don't want to schedule us, unquote. And again, that feature is entitled Notre Dame versus Indiana, the rivalry that wasn't takes center stage in the college football playoff. Among the four college playoff games this weekend, this Notre Dame-Indiana matchup is the only one taking place on Friday, December the 20th. Game time is at 6 p.m. Arizona time on ESPN and ABC. Three other playoff games in its first round will be taking place on Saturday. The University of Texas will be taking on Clemson on Saturday. Game time is at 2 p.m. Pacific time on TNT, taking place in Texas at the Darrell Royal Texas Memorial Stadium in Austin. Another Saturday matchup is Penn State taking on SMU Saturday. Game time for this one is actually in the morning hours at 10 a.m. Arizona time on TNT, and it's taking place at Beaver Stadium at State College, Pennsylvania. And the third game on Saturday is the one evening game, Ohio State versus Tennessee. This game will start at 6 p.m. Arizona time on ESPN and ABC, taking place at Ohio Stadium in Columbus, Ohio, again at 6 p.m. Arizona time. And in other college football news, this headline reads, Colorado two-way star Hunter wins the Heisman. This feature written by Scooby Axton of USA Today, Dateline, New York. Travis Hunter, a dynamic two-way player who helped Colorado win five more games in 2024 than the previous year while playing nearly 1,400 snaps on offense and defense, won the Heisman Memorial Trophy as college football's most outstanding player on Saturday night. Hunter is Colorado's second Heisman winner, following running back Rashawn Salaam, who won it back in 1994. Hunter's win temporarily broke a quarterback stranglehold on the award, as 20 of the 23 previous winners this century played quarterback. Along with Hunter, Alabama running backs Mark Ingram and Derrick Henry and Crimson Tide wide receiver Devonta Smith are the only non-quarterback winners since the year 2000. Hunter received 552 first-place votes and 2,231 total points. Boise State running back Ashton Jeanty was second in the voting, and Oregon quarterback Dylan Gabriel came in third, and Miami quarterback Cam Ward was fourth. Hunter was on 93.3% of the total ballots and won five of the six voting regions. Arizona State running back Cam Skatape rushed for just 25 yards across both meetings against Seattle. In both matchups against the Seahawks, Arizona combined to go 7 for 24 on third downs and 1 out of 5 in the red zone. The next two games of the schedule are favorable, but the Cardinals close with the Rams and the 49ers. And from football news, let's turn now to some baseball news. Headline reads, Soto bet on himself to get $765 million. And this feature written by Bob Nightingale, columnist for USA Today. Dateline, Dallas. Juan Soto made it quite clear that he was going to sign with the highest bidder when he became a free agent after the New York Yankees lost the World Series. He was a man of his word. Soto agreed to a staggering 15-year, $765 million contract last Sunday night with the New York Mets, shattering the record for the biggest contract in sports history. The Yankees, Boston Red Sox, and Toronto Blue Jays all made bids of at least $700 million, but the Mets came in with the highest, just $5 million more than the Yankees' 16-year, $760 million contract, a high-ranking Yankees executive told USA Today Sports. Yet while there was only a $5 million difference overall, the annual average salary of the Mets contract is $51 million compared to the Yankees' $47.5 million. The deal also does not include a penny of deferred money with a $75 million signing bonus, along with an opt-out after the fifth year. If the contract wasn't already big enough, it could be worth $805 million, a person with direct knowledge of the deal told USA Today Sports. The Mets have the right to void Soto's buyout if they increase his salary from $51 million to $55 million beginning in 2030 for 10 years. Soto's deal is more than $300 million richer than any contract in the history of baseball. Shohei Ohtani signed a 10-year, $700 million contract last year with the Los Angeles Dodgers, but with $780 million deferred, it lowered the present-day value to about $460 million. And just like that, Mets owner Steve Cohen, the richest owner in baseball with a net worth of about $21 billion, showed off his financial clout by refusing to be outbid. He also views it as a shrewd investment opportunity, not only helping the Mets escape the Yankees' shadow in New York, but providing a significant boost at the gates. The Mets suffered the largest attendance decline in the National League last season, drawing a quarter million fewer than in 2023, despite ultimately reaching the National League Championship Series. Now they'll believe that with Soto aboard, they'll gain a significant uptick in season ticket sales, hoping to draw 3 million fans for the first time since 2009. While Soto was informing the Mets that he was coming their way, the Washington Nationals front office was having dinner at the Anatole Hotel, remembering that 2.5 years ago they had offered Soto a 15-year, $440 million deferred contract. Soto's declining of the offer turned out to be the best financial investment since Tesla, and perhaps the Nationals' most prudent decision by trading him to San Diego in July of 2022, knowing that they could not afford to sign him to an extension. While the talk was always that Soto was seeking a $500 million contract and perhaps even broaching $600 million once Ohtani signed, no one could have imagined that he would hit $700 million with four teams still in the bidding, with the Mets adding $30 million to their last offer on Sunday. And again, that feature is entitled Soto Bet on Himself to Get $765 Million, written by Bob Nightingale, columnist for USA Today. And another baseball feature, also written by Bob Nightingale, headline reads, Dick Allen, Dave Parker named to the Baseball Hall of Fame, Dateline Dallas. They prayed, they held hands, and when they finally heard the news they've been awaiting for four decades, the Dick Allen family broke into tears, hugged one another tightly, and yelled, "Finally! Finally!" Dick Allen, who was on the ballot for the first time in 1983, was elected Sunday night into the Baseball Hall of Fame by the Classic Baseball Era Committee, alongside longtime friend Dave Parker. "It was like champagne popped," said his son Richard Allen Jr., age 59. "I wanted to hear it. I wanted to see it. We saw it. Big sigh of relief. Really, there's a lifetime of emotion just pouring out. It was worth the wait. It just makes it that much more exciting. Long overdue, long overdue," unquote. The family, with Allen Jr., his son Trey, and nephew Rick Allen, who sat together in a private room at the Anatole Hotel, received calls from Hall of Famer Goose Gossage, Philadelphia Phillies owner John Middleton, and friends and families throughout the country. Middleton, who's responsible for the Phillies retiring Allen's number 3 months before he died at the age of 78 in the year 2020, openly cried when he heard the news. "I am still crying thinking about it," Middleton said. "I just wish he was here to enjoy it," unquote. Yes, the shame is that Dick Allen won't be walking across the stage at the induction ceremony this summer. But the truth, Allen Jr. said, is that his dad would have wanted everyone to rejoice and regale in baseball's ultimate honor without him anyway. This is why the family planned to celebrate the Hall of Fame in a way that Allen would have wanted, throwing back some cold beers to celebrate. "I'll be honest with you guys," Allen Jr. said. "He always loved the green Heinekens. That's what we're getting. Ready to get some green ones," unquote. Allen laughed, knowing that if his father were alive, he would still rather talk about the horses than his 15-year professional baseball career, earning 7 All-Star berths, the 1964 Rookie of the Year Award with the Phillies, and the 1972 MVP Award with the Chicago White Sox. "You know, he never wanted to talk about it," Allen Jr. said. "He never did talk about it. He always thanked and felt other people were more deserving. I used to tell him, 'Your numbers are just as good. You should be there. You should be there.' And he's like, 'Yeah, I'm all right. I'm all right.' So how it happened, it was so good," unquote. Allen was on the Hall of Fame ballot 14 years and twice was on the contemporary era ballot, falling one vote short in 2014 and once again in the year 2021. Well, on this night, that heartbreak turned into euphoria when Hall of Fame President Josh Rawich began reading Allen's stats, with the family immediately knowing that they were about to officially announce Dick Allen. He received 13 votes from the 8-member committee, one more than necessary. They didn't even hear Rawich call out his name on the TV set, with the celebration reverberating in the Cardinal A room at the Anatole Hotel. "We did it! We did it! He made it! He got in!" unquote. And then there was Goose Gossage, who has been lobbying for Allen for years, calling him the most instrumental teammate of his career on speakerphone, yelling, "No freaking way!" If Allen were alive, his family said, they're not even sure that he would have shown any emotion. This is a man who would much rather talk about his love for horse racing than his baseball career. He's probably telling one of his old stories, his horse stories, Allen Jr. said, deflecting the honor, but appreciative of it at the same time. They actually had to mail him the MVP trophy because he didn't take it, so that is his humbleness. So for this, I think he is happier that I would be doing this and not him, unquote. If the evening could possibly be any sweeter, it was the news that Dave Parker, his longtime friend from the Pittsburgh Pirates, would be going into the Hall of Fame together. Allen Jr. still has a glove, Cobra 19, that Parker gave him as a kid. He still has a large photograph of the two together. Now, after battling deep-seated racism during their era, with Allen once wearing a baseball helmet playing first base because of objects thrown from the stands, they will be linked together forever in baseball immortality, a day that the Allen family began to doubt would ever happen. "I had kind of lost faith," Allen Jr. said. "I kind of thought that, you know, eventually he'd be forgotten, and the people that were not knowing him to watch him play, that they would be gone and his family's passed away," unquote. Now he'll be forever remembered, not for the iconic Sports Illustrated cover in which he was juggling baseballs while smoking a cigarette, but for being one of the greatest players to play the game. He was one of the premier power hitters of his generation, with 6 seasons of more than 30 homers and 6 seasons hitting at least .300. He had the highest slugging percentage and OPS of every player with at least 3,000 plate appearances from 1964 to 1974, with the exception of Hall of Famer Hank Aaron. Dave Parker was also one of the most feared hitters in his 19-year career. The 7-time All-Star won the 1978 MVP award, hitting .290 for his lifetime batting average, with 2,712 hits, 339 homers, and 1,493 RBIs. Quote, "I've been holding this speech in for 15 years, said Parker, who has been battling Parkinson's disease. "This has been a long time coming," unquote. Yes, indeed, for both of these sluggers. And again, this feature is entitled Dick Allen and Dave Parker Named to the Baseball Hall of Fame, written by Bob Nightingale, columnist for USA Today. And in other baseball news, this next headline reads, Spurned Yankees and Soto Losers Forced to Pivot. This feature written by Gabe Lackus of USA Today. For the losers in the Juan Soto Derby, all is not lost. Just one of the greatest free agents of all time and a generational left-handed hitter is all. Yet it's nothing that cannot necessarily be overcome now that Soto is a New York Met for the norm-shattering price of $765 million over 15 years. The Mets are guaranteed nothing save for a level of relevance possibly not seen since the 1980s and a cog in their lineup for the next decade and a half. So what do plans B, C, and D look like for the spurned finalists? Let's explore. Let's look at the Yankees. How does Batman replace Robin in the lineup? No need to sugarcoat it. This is devastating for the Yankees. Juan Soto and Aaron Judge made for one of the great middle-of-the-order duos in Major League history, combining for 99 home runs, joining with Giancarlo Stanton to reestablish a punishing Bronx Bombers presence and drive the Yankees to their first World Series since 2009. With Soto tossed around like high-end leftovers through three franchises the past 3 years, he wasn't going to miss his chance at calling his own shots, finally. And the Yankees knew the advantage of their 1 year of speed dating was only going to go so far. You get the sense that owner Hal Steinbrenner got the sense that there would be no way he would outbid Mets counterpart Steve Cohen, although adding a 16th year to the deal was a little bit pound foolish. Once you're playing in that stratosphere, why even bother thinking about the luxury tax? There are times to play the George Steinbrenner is dead card when analyzing Hal's maneuverings, but this probably is not one of them. Lest we forget, when George passed away in the year 2010, the Mets owner had recently lost close to $1 billion in a Ponzi scheme. Steve Cohen is not Fred Wilpon, and for all of the Steinbrenner's generational wealth, the game has changed when hedge fund kingpins like Cohen own a ball club. Cannot fault Hal too much for saying uncle when he was getting yanked down the Cohen's bottomless pit of cash. What now? The answers for the Yankees are all suboptimal to a degree. The Yankees can try to add power and address badly needed upgrades by pursuing Alex Bregman, Pete Alonso, or Christian Walker, with the first two options likely costing in excess of $200 million. All three are right-handed hitters, however, which would badly imbalance the lineup around Judge. That's where a trade for Cody Bellinger makes so much sense. They could likely import the lefty-hitting, athletically elite first baseman slash outfielder from the Cubs for not much more than taking on the potential $52 million owed Bellinger this year and next year. He has a player option for 2026. Bellinger-Bregman would be a dynamic combo and could nudge Judge back to an outfield corner. It also would not hamstring the Yankees with too many dudes on long contracts well into their 30s, which is what an Alonzo Bergman exacta might look like, short-term gains notwithstanding. Lest we forget, the Yankees finished last season with a pretty good starting pitching situation with Gerrit Cole, Carlos Rodon, Clark Schmidt, and Luis Gil, all upright and often outstanding. That gives them a big advantage over almost every club, both on the field and in their winter pursuits. Sure, they can toss their hat in the Roki Susaki sweepstakes, which would be a massive boon. But in terms of big-ticket items, a lefty bat and an elite corner guy would go a long way towards fulfilling the task that the Yankees did not want to undertake, replacing Soto in the aggregate. Then there are the Toronto Blue Jays, who are also trying to sign Soto. The Blue Jays will be going for a three-peat next year. Only come 2025, their own superstar will be the one in position to spurn their big money offer. Now the Blue Jays need to worry about locking up Vladimir Guerrero Jr. Perhaps we'll learn more in the weeks and months ahead, but it was probably an easy no for Soto on Toronto when his would-be running mate in the lineup, the prodigious slugger Guerrero, was not signed beyond this year. For a guy who desired control and certainly that his future club was going to win for a decade plus to come, Soto could easily see a Guerrero-free future of 200 walks and third-place finishes in Toronto. And again, that feature is entitled Spurned Yankees and Soto Losers Forced to Pivot, written by Gabe Lackus of USA Today. That's all the time that we have for this edition of Sports Today. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Have a great evening. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.